Welcome, everyone, to The Peaceful Planet. This is show host Marcia McMahon, and you were listening to a very cool tune called The Radical Dolphin, and that is produced by John Lennon. Don, are you on the line?
I can be, yes.
I need you to connect with Jerry. We need to get Jerry on the line.
Let's bring him on. Stay with me.
So anyway, we're getting our guest right now, Jerry E. Smith, and in the process, I have a very special message that I'd like to read for you, and this is called John Lennon. Hi, and welcome to The Peaceful Planet. Sorry about that. We didn't quite have our guest, Jerry Smith, on the line, and we're going to be doing some other things at the top of the hour before we get to him. Jerry, are you there with us?
Yes.
Wonderful. Okay, we're glad to have you. We're opening our show, and I mentioned that the first song we heard was called Radical Dolphin. This has been written and composed by John Lennon on the other side, and these songs are being synthesized from spirit through the mediumship of Robert Murray. And recently, in a recent message I got from John, he's asked that the listeners, our listening audience, would call the program and request some of the songs that we are currently featuring all the time on the show. And if you know a song and you'd like to visit Bob Murray's website at www.thestarsstillshine.com and find a song by either John or George, call us up at 877-876-5227, and we'll be glad to play a song for you. The songs are just awesome, and they're beautifully composed. I'm doing the lyrics while Bob is doing the music end of it, and he's working with a synthesizer and a computer. And then more recently, our own Chris Moores has taken some of my lyrics and some of Bob's synthesized tunes from John and translated them into his own version. So later in the show, midpoint, we're going to hear another version of Radical Dolphin set to words. It was John's thought that these songs could be projected out into the mass consciousness and have the effect of world peace by sort of getting into the remote part of our brains, but just, you know how it is when you're singing a song and it's just the lyrics just go right through you, channel through you almost. And that is the idea. So if you have a song or you would like a reading, maybe you're feeling a need for some direction from the angels today, again, the number to call is 877-876-5227. And this is The Peaceful Planet with show host Marcia McMahon. So I'm going to be reading to you this message from John, and I have another message from Princess Diana. And these are really important messages, and I think you'll find the first one from John to be really inspiring. And it's titled, John Lennon Speaks on Free Love, The Beatles, and BBS Radio. And I received this message July 5th, and I connected with John, and I'm speaking here. Dear John, well, I'm here on the page and making contact. How is life on the other side these days? John, laughing. Pretty much the same, Marcia, my dear. George and I have been creating a lot of new music, and we'll feature it on your great show soon. Marcia, I got to thinking to ask Don to revise the music debut we did so that it comes in loud and clear, as he said that some of it was barely audible. John, yeah, at the very least that should be done so that you do get noticed as you are going to go big. Marcia, you keep telling me that, John. I suppose Bob Murray will go big since it's his music. I would like the lyrics out there in the mass consciousness. There is now such a profound need for peace. We have Israel and Palestine on the verge of war, and the North Korean dictator launching missiles on the 4th of July. It seems to me there are nations around the world that want aggressive military action, besides the United States, which feels entitled to military action. John, your message and your work couldn't be more important than now, especially since Diana's words can prevent terror on America. I'm not patriotic, as you know, and was the rebel spirit in the Beatles, but nonetheless, I don't want any more terror upon America, because America is the only free country among just a few. We had to go big in America because that was where the future light workers of ascension would be. We had them in England too, the whole generation. But without freedom there in America, there wouldn't have been free love. Although it was Yoko and I, our dream of our honeymoon, for God's sake, it caught on in America. That is why so much channeling and spirit work with angels is happening in America. America's the leader for all spiritual waves, and frankly, CBS Radio is the leader for radio in America. It's what every station should be. There are dark forces that don't want this kind of light work and peace work being done. We applaud Don and his brother Doug for their efforts. We'd like to see all his shows out there, but particularly yours, Marcia, since it can have a wide-reaching effect of peace, both through the music and through Diana's words being read on the air. Well, John, that's quite a compliment. I'm going to share this with our producer, Don Newsom, and I think he'll feel well pleased with his extraordinary efforts. John, by all means, share my thoughts with your friend Don, with my blessing. And remember, all you need is love. Marcia, thanks for your communication here, John. I will forward more music with Bob Murray. John, yeah, we'll be sending it through Bob. We'd like to ask our listeners to please call the station and request songs during your reading time, too. We want to put it out there and really make an impact. Marcia, I'll mention it to Don, and thanks again, John. John, you're welcome. Remember peace. Remember love. Ciao. Bye for now, John. So with that thought, I'm going to move into Princess Diana's message, because he's asked me to read these messages, and I haven't read any for a while. For those of you that are just tuning into our show, The Peaceful Planet, we do focus on peace issues occasionally, and messages that I have from Spirit. And this one that came in this week from Princess Diana is particularly relevant to the situation in Israel and Palestine, which is a cause of concern right now, because they are in the possible verge of war. And she's asking all of you light workers and peace workers out there to focus your thoughts and positive energy, at least give your time to thinking of the people in those situations who are caught and trapped in mutual violence and mutual hatreds, who don't want to play that out. And we want a peaceful solution, so please remember that. We'll get into a little bit more about this after I read the message. My messages are posted online at www.dianaspeakstotheworld.com, and the title of my book is With Love from Diana, Queen of Hearts. Should you find this message inspiring, that's where you can find more of them. So I'll open. Diana speaks on her causes and tensions in Palestine. Received by Marcia McMahon, July the 4th. So this was sort of a 4th of July message, and it is quite powerful. Marcia, Diana, I'm here at your request. I've been reading the situation in the Middle East and assume you wish to speak on that. Indeed, you are brilliant, and I'm so glad to have your continued service to your country. As I have said many times, you have no idea, really, what a divine blessing you have been to your people, Americans. However, at the moment, I find myself dismayed at the verge of war there in the Palestinian territories and in Gaza. Tanks and mortar are ready to pound the innocent Palestinian people, and diplomatic efforts are continuing via Egypt and other Arab countries that want peace with Israel. I think it was shameful of Israel to bomb Prime Minister Abbas' headquarters there when he has consistently stood up for the release of the soldier held captive, for the recognition also of the state of Israel and Palestine. That this increased aggression is sending war signals all over the Middle East. And now we hear of planes making their air aggression and defense systems into Syria. While I totally confirm their president, Mr. Assad, is involved in terrorist plots and the support of Hamas, we reserve caution at Israel's aggressive policy in this instance, though I am not saying I do not support Israel in her right to defend herself. Let me be clear here. We, in Spirit, do not take sides. If we did, we would be operating on the same human level that most in your world do. No, as an ascended master, I see all sides and all injustices, and as Queen of Hearts, the world and world peace ambassador that I am, I stand with innocent and suffering children the world over. From my vantage point, it is perfectly apparent that children suffer the most in these man-made conflicts, and I am attempting to stop war on all fronts. My job is not easy, nor has the job of my channel been an easy one. She has endured much ridicule, but this should not deter her most important work. Her work can totally prevent a Holocaust, a future Holocaust on American soil, and on this day of American independence, many Americans would be wise to consider the wisdom of this message. For I confirm it is I, Diana, the one so loved all over the world, and taken out of your world for the very same reason. I stood up for peace, for children everywhere against landmines, and for this I was removed from the world stage, and my life with my lover Dodi, and my beloved sons. It would behoove the world to look deeper into the person I was and understand the causes I held are those that are still dear to my heart, those causes being children the world over. Indeed, we all pray for a peaceful solution. Meanwhile, the Palestinians' power has been bombed out and the tanks remain poised to strike. On this day of independence, it would behoove Americans to think of others not like themselves who suffer from the tyranny of occupation and assist them, meaning, of course, the cause of the Palestinians. We do not ask you to stand with any terrorists, obviously, but to stand with moderates within the ranks of the Palestinian Authority, such as the good person Saeb Erekat and the president, Mr. Abbas. Ask that more be done to assist these moderates who want no violence upon anyone and assist Israel in the creating of the Palestinian state. For indeed, had my channel been heard and her message implemented, it would, as planned, the situation in Gaza would not be unfolding and much needless suffering and bloodshed would be averted. My love to all this day of independence, Diana, Queen of Hearts and Ambassador for Peace. So Diana gave a powerful message asking also that you send on emails to elected representatives and ask that more be done to work with the moderates in the Palestinian territories. The elected president and the chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, and others. I follow this situation closely weekly, and I do a weekly message. If you have an interest in this, you can send an email to dianaspeaks@hotmail.com and ask to be added to the weekly email list. I think it's important that both John and Diana are emphasizing that their work is still continuing for peace. I didn't hear any requests for any songs and or any readings, but we are opening up songs and readings. And if you have questions for our special guest, I will be introducing him momentarily. And I want to remind you again, the number to call is 877-876-5227. And so now I would like to give you a little bit of background information on Jerry E. Smith. Jerry, are you there with us?
Yes. And,
okay.
My name is Jerry Wenstrom.
Oh. I'm sorry. Do we have the wrong person on the line here? I was supposed to be connecting to Jerry Smith with the Secrets of the Holy Land.
Nope, wrong person.
Oh, boy. I apologize. Well, we were just tuning in to Radical Dolphin. That was a version that was done by our own Chris Morris, and it has a great sound. Chris actually has kind of a Lennon sound. Now we actually do have the one and only Jerry E. Smith. We had the wrong Jerry before. I can't believe that happened, but mistakes do happen, and apparently the wrong Jerry had been dialed, and the guy was perfectly willing to go along with it. So I don't know. I think I'm kind of interested in interviewing this other guy, Jerry Wenstrom, too, sometime. Jerry, we apologize that happened, and we're so glad to have you with us. I'm going to read a little bit of background information about our special guest, Jerry E. Smith, and then a little bit about the content of his very interesting book, continuing in our Special Grail series. And again, you're tuned in to The Peaceful Planet with show host Marcia McMahon. This is about Jerry. Jerry E. Smith has been a writer, editor, and activist for over three decades in the early 90s. He was the executive director of the National UFO Museum in Reno, Nevada. His bibliography of published works includes scores of articles and reviews and over a dozen ghost-written books and two nonfiction works from Adventures Unlimited Press, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, and Secrets of the Holy Lance. And we're going to be discussing Secrets of the Holy Lance, and this is a little bit of background on that particular book. The Secrets of the Holy Lance and the Spear of Destiny in History and Legend by Jerry E. Smith and George Picard weave together the many threads of the Spear of Destiny's legend like no book before it ever has. according to the Gospel of John in the New Testament, as Jesus Christ hung on the cross, a Roman centurion pierced his side with a lance. A legend has arisen that whoever possesses this lance and understands the power it serves holds in his hand the destiny of the world for good or evil. Secrets of the Holy Lance places this legend against the backdrop of world history from its appearance at the crucifixion, its use by Constantine, Rome's first Christian Caesar, to Charlemagne's claim that when he ruled with it, he ruled the Roman Emperor by divine right. So on that introduction, I'd like to welcome you to our program, Jerry. I'm glad we finally have you. We have the right Jerry on the line. How are you today?
Well, I'm good. Good to be with you.
Mm-hmm. Good to have you with us. You have a fascinating book here.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, it was quite extensive, and the research you have seems to span about 2,000 or 3,000 years, and you're all over the ancient history and uncovering all kinds of different things regarding the lance. Let's open by explaining maybe to our listeners a little bit more about the Spear of Destiny and how it appears, say, in the Gospels and what we know of it from a historical perspective in the biblical times to start out with.
Okay. Well, most of what we know about the lance actually comes from outside of the Bible, from from the log books of the Bible, the so-called Apocrypha. And this particularly, like the Acts of Pilate, the Gospels of Nicodemus, and so forth. In the New Testament, we only have in the book of John, where it's mentioned very briefly, that a centurion stepped forward to stop the soldiers from breaking the limbs of Jesus and pierced him with his side to show that he was already dead, so they didn't need to do that. And in the Gospel of Nicodemus, we learn why he did this, that the centurion was named Longinus, and Longinus was an elderly man going blind and had been put on light duty, basically following Jesus around, basic Red Squad, Homeland Security stuff, where he was spying on Jesus and had done so for a period of time and had come to appreciate, perhaps even worship him. And the soldiers were breaking the legs of the men so that they would die faster, because when you die on the cross, as long as you can keep pushing up with your legs, you stay alive, because it's the weight of the body on the arms that constricts the chest muscles that suffocates you to death.
And so that's how Jesus actually expired then on the cross.
Well, there's some debate about this. In the Gospel of John, it says that when Longinus pierced his side, or rather when the centurion pierced his side, out came blood and water. And some have speculated that Jesus may have died of a heart attack rather than dying of the suffocation, and that the spear may have pierced the pericardium, the sac around the heart. There are many questions.
So anyway, the spear itself is what we call in art history, I'm an art historian, what we call a holy relic.
Exactly.
Can you tell us a little bit about the reverence that pilgrims all over the world have for these relics, and whether you think these relics are imbued with sort of a spiritual healing power or a spiritual power for good or evil?
Well, virtually every religion on this planet believes in the power of relics. And the basic concept is that there is a greater universe to which the universe of the senses that we live in is a lesser universe. And that the greater universes were God, the powers, angels, demons, angelic beings, etc. live, and that the supernatural, as we know it, is a leakage from the greater universe into this universe of the senses, and that those who became holy men, saints, prophets, etc., became that way because they were touched from outside. They were touched from the greater universe and became a channel for the wisdom, the power of the greater universe to affect the lesser universe. And in
That's
doing so...
That's beautifully put. You know, you have an eloquence there with your words, and You're not just speaking of the Christian religion. You're speaking of all religions having
exactly.
sacred relics.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Very nice. Okay.
So,
keep going.
So the idea is that the saint, the holy man, the prophet has been touched by God or the supernatural, and his beingness has been imbued with this greaterness. And the things associated with him stay. They hold the charge, if you will, so that his bones are more than just bones, and keeping his bones is more than just a memento to remind the worshipers what the holy man did and said, but are actually contact points to the other side, and the relics are venerated in the hope, in the belief that the power will come through that relic and touch the supplicant.
And there were many stories. The actual use of relics is well documented in the early Christian eras. I'm thinking particularly of the story of Veronica's Veil and also the Shroud of Turin and other more well-known relics, along with the Holy Grail and all these others, that these were actual encounters that people had with Jesus. In fact, with, you know, Veronica, that's well recounted in that she hands him something and wipes his face and he leaves an image on her face. So the early history of images and icons more or less derives from these relics, the idea that these objects carry or impart the supernatural to them. So, but the lance is a curious blessing and curse, if I may. It seems to me from reading your book that those that hold the lance seem to hold a lot of power, and there have been historical figures that have fought to the death with the lance and came into owning the lance, and then those people seem to have ruled the world. Give us an example of some of those people I'm thinking of that you highlight in your book.
Well, a couple of the most spectacular were Constantine, Charlemagne, and Adolf Hitler. Constantine's possession of the lance is probably the single most important event in Christian history after the crucifixion. With the lance, Constantine had his famous vision, and that demonstrated both in today's parlance clairvoyance and clairaudience. He saw in the sky a sign and heard a voice say to him, "With this sign you will conquer." He then had the sign marched before his soldiers and possibly put on all their shields, and indeed did conquer and become the ruler of the empire. The lance spoke to him several times while he possessed it. It told him to move his capital from Rome to this odd little town of Byzantium, an ancient Greek town.
Right.
Byzantium then became the ruler of the Byzantine Empire and was the capital of one of the greatest empires in human history that lasted for some 1,400 years.
We have a great deal of legacy of Byzantine art. That's how it came to be. And Constantine did a lot of other things. I didn't mean to interrupt. Keep going, please.
Another aspect of this, and probably the most important piece of Constantine's rule, was that Constantine, as the emperor, was also the Pontus Maximus. He was the pontiff of the official Roman state religion, which was going in the tank at the time. Rome was awash in alien cultures and alien religions. He decided
so-called.
The way to... I'm sorry, dear?
No, I was just saying so-called pagan religion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, pagan actually is a word meaning country dweller. Christianity started in the cities. And so the folks who lived out in the country were the last ones to adopt it, and so it became a derisive term of those who would hold out to the old religion against the new. Constantine, as the Pontus Maximus, decided that he needed to be able to rule both the physical empire and the religious empire.
Mm-hmm. And there you get all the power. All
exactly.
Rome is one.
And so he called the first Council of Nicaea, And at the first, the purpose of the First Council of Nicaea was to form a universal religion of all the religions in the empire. You may remember the word Catholic means universal. And the Catholic Church began with the Council of Nicaea.
That's a very good scholarship.
And one of the often asked questions is, why is it that that Christians don't believe in reincarnation? And it goes to the very first day of the Council of Nicaea, which Constantine ruled holding the spear clutched to his bosom throughout the week of the conference. And of the first day of the conference, they took a vote on whether the universal religion would preach reincarnation or not. And after the vote, all those who voted yes, Constantine ordered taken out and killed.
Mm-hmm. So they got rid of reincarnation, which was, in fact, at the time of Jesus, something that everybody embraced, I believe. And it's a shame. They got rid of a lot of other important gospels, too, like the Gnostic gospels.
Exactly.
At that. So these people that were holding differing beliefs than Constantine were basically just taken out and killed then, you're saying?
Yes, yes.
So no wonder we get the Bible that we get, and no wonder we don't have any women in leadership in the Bible and so on. It's all been distorted, basically.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There are, if you find original manuscripts and then the versions thereof, each book that is canonical, each book that is currently in the Bible, collectively there are more than 200,000 versions of them, many of which are seriously in disagreement with each other.
Oh, yes. Oh.
So anybody who thinks that the Bible is the literal word of God and should be taken, that each word is exactly the way it's supposed to be, is just whistling in the dark.
Exactly. I mean, and so, you know, the truth be told, there's far more evidence for the to support some of the new theories that are coming to light, say, with, for instance, the Da Vinci Code movie and the idea of the Holy Grail being Mary Magdalene and there being a bloodline and the Templars and all of that. Did the Templars ever have any connection to the Spear of Destiny?
A distant one.
Mm-hmm.
There are several objects claimed to be the spear. There are about five or six of them roaming around the planet at the moment. There is one in the Vatican. There's one in a monastery in Armenia. There's one in a museum in Vienna. There's another in a museum in Krakow, Poland. There may be another one hidden somewhere in Europe. The one in the Vatican is the one that the Templars had a bit to do with.
Tell us about that.
Now, the variations on how all these objects track back to the crucifixion is based on the stories of where Longinus went after the crucifixion. Some of the stories say that the centurion stayed in the Holy Land, became a Christian. When the blood and water came out, it splashed in his eyes, curing his blindness, which converted him to Christianity on the spot. He then preached Christianity in the Holy Land and achieved a Christian martyrdom there. That lance remained on display up until Jerusalem was overrun by the Muslims in the 800s. It was last seen around 660. At that point in time, the tip had been broken off. The tip was given to a Frankish king who took it to France, and the tip was on display up until the French Revolution when it vanished during the Revolution. The body of the lance head disappeared after the Muslim invasion of Jerusalem and then reappeared around the year 1000. At that time, the Sultan who ruled all of Islam died and left two sons and no clear heir. And the two sons had a war as to who was going to be the Sultan. And, of course, one won and one lost. And the loser bugged out and went over to the Christians and surrendered to the Templar Knights. And the Templar Knights promptly realized that he was too hot a potato to handle and packed him off to Rome and gave him to the Pope. At which point the winning brother back in Islam goes, oh my goodness, this guy could spill an awful lot of beans I don't want spilled, and he offered to the Pope to buy his brother back, and paid one of the largest ransoms in human history. It was a small mountain of gold, bags of precious gems, and just to sweeten the deal, he threw in the Holy Lance. So the Holy Lance got to the Vatican around 1000 AD, and for the next several hundred years, there was continuous debate over whether it was the real deal or not. And finally, around 1400 or 1500, the Pope got sick of it, sick of all the arguing, and came up with a rather novel solution to it. There was a throne that he used to rule from, and he had a decorative roof put over the throne, supported by four pillars, and had the lance walled up inside one of the support pillars.
Hmm.
Now, that's just one of the objects, and the one that's best known, the one that most people are think of when they think of the Spear of Destiny, is the one in the museum in Vienna. And
right,
that,
and that's the one that apparently is on the picture of your book.
Exactly.
And it's been gold leafed over, but that originates supposedly with the crucifixion.
Right. Now, that lance, that story is that Joseph of Arimathea claimed Jesus' body and had it put into his own as yet unused sepulcher, and that Joseph and Longinus became friends and traveled together to the British Isles. Joseph was a rich trader, and he traded in tin, and the tin mines were in Britain. And they went to Britain, and Joseph founded Glastonbury Abbey, and together they brought Christianity to the British Isles.
You know, that's just amazing, too. If you let me interject now and then, I'm drawing so many parallels because just last week we had Mark Amaral Tinkham on with his Guardians of the Grail, and he was talking about the very same thing. So, you know, I know all the research that our guests are bringing to our Grail Mysteries is corroborated, not just from one source.
There you go.
So these are not just necessarily stories, but actual research that's been done into the ancient history. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but I had to interject
your
thoughts there, Jerry.
Sure.
So continue on with the story of the lance.
The first person after Longinus to possess the lance was Queen Boadicea, and Queen Boadicea is a very remarkable creature both then and now. She was possibly Roman, married to a British king, welcomed the Romans into the British Isles and welcomed Christianity into her kingdom. When her husband died, she attempted to rule the kingdom, and the Romans wouldn't hear to it. And when she protested, they had the executioner publicly rape her daughters and whip her, which rather filled her with hatred. She used the Holy Lance to get revenge, and laid down the first track, if you will, of what the lance is capable of, in which one of the powers it seems to have is granting invincibility in battle. And she used it and was invincible. Whenever she was in battle against the Romans, she always won. And they only finally took her when they caught her sleeping and attacked her camp in the middle of the night. She and the daughters escaped, but they were separated from the Holy Lance. And rather than submit to more Roman indignities, they committed suicide. The lance disappeared then for a couple of hundred years, and eventually ends up with Constantine. And Constantine is also invincible in battle with it.
I would say that Constantine, as I recall, ruled over the entire Roman Empire, both as the emperor and the head of the church simultaneously.
Right. Well, eventually. It took a while. What ends up in the book is I spent all of last summer, all the summer 2004, researching Constantine, and just got amazed by it. And George Picard, my co-author, and I had a funny way of doing the book. We basically divided the book into George wrote the Nazi stuff, and I wrote the ancient history and the Antarctic stuff. And I hope
I'm glad we're dealing with your end of the book and not the other, because there's so much to it. I'm not discounting what George has done. He's done some fine research. But vibrationally, I don't feel like opening up the whole thing of Hitler, the Holocaust, and all of that.
I think
that's for another discussion. And I think that your interest in the ancient side, the history of the lance, and its supernatural powers and its spiritual power is perhaps what I would like to focus on. So,
right.
Yes,
but,
I did read the whole book, though, and, it is very fascinating. It seems to have, you know, it's like what they say about a double-edged sword, the old saying, you know, everything is a double-edged sword. That's what this lance appears to be, because not only do the people who are benevolent seem to rule with great authority when they're holding the lance, but it seems to also, when it falls into the wrong hands, these people seem to take power.
Exactly. Where I was going with that was that mm-hmm. George and I had a writing style. We each wrote our first drafts and passed it to the other. George would write his first drafts and pass it to me, and I'd add to them. I'd write my first drafts and pass it to him, and he'd subtract from them. So the section on Constantine ended up being about 55 pages long, but I actually wrote about 125 pages.
Well, I know you're quite an expert, and you know it's all very good research, and it is fascinating. You went into a great deal of depth about his family and how he came into power, and then didn't he marry also for prestige and wealth? He had one wife and then took another. Was there something?
No, that
like
was his father.
Constantine's
mother, Saint Helena. We don't really know whether she ever married Constantine's father, also named Constantine, making Constantine Jr. We don't really know whether they ever got married or whether she was a concubine or what, but after giving birth to Constantine, Dad decided that having an innkeeper's daughter wasn't politically expedient enough, and married the oldest daughter of one of the two ruling emperors. Constantine Jr. ended up marrying the youngest daughter of the same emperor,
would
making father and son also brothers-in-law.
Would that have been then Theodora?
Constantinus Chlorus, Dad, married Theodora, and Constantine the Great married Fausta.
Oh, okay, because I remember seeing the murals of Constantine and Theodora in the Byzantine churches. There's murals of them.
Hmm. Well, there was Theodora, Justinian's wife.
Oh, okay, I'm thinking of Theodora.
Yeah, you're thinking
Justinian's
of Justinian
wife.
And
yeah.
Theodora.
Justinian. Now, did Justinian also have possession of the lance?
Yes, he did. He was the last Roman emperor to have the lance. And he used the lance. Again, one of the things the lance does is it talks to its owner and gives advice and direction to its owner,
now
or at least why the owners claim that their inspiration came from a chat with the lance. Justinian claimed.
If I may interject with that thought, I think there's some significance to that too. If you don't mind me interrupting and interjecting this thought, but as a psychic, you know, I have picked up objects and received messages.
Mm-hmm.
Not from the object, but from the person who held the object. So certainly if a person carries an object on their person for their lifetime, they're going to leave what they call, in our parlance, an energetic imprint.
Mm-hmm.
And all objects, if they are the personal possession of someone and they're dearly cherished, like a diamond ring or something, you can do readings from objects.
Oh, absolutely.
So there is absolute truth in the idea that the lance would have picked up all these vibrations, not to mention the fact that if it's a real thing and these people are in the possession of the lance that pierced the side of Jesus, the greatest teacher yet to appear, then it would seem that there would be great energy, possibly healing power, but also this incredible destructive power.
Exactly. And one of the things that George and I went back and forth on is George believed that Jesus was real and was a great teacher. And I believe that Jesus never existed, that it was a carefully constructed con. However, that doesn't mean that this object did not pick up power or have powers pick it up.
It up from your book, Terry. I didn't get that. I got reverence for the Christian religion, so I find that an interesting revelation.
Well, you were picking up the George side of the story on that one.
Right,
you know, what I was looking at is that the spear in Vienna was scientifically tested in 2003, and the testing was absolutely conclusive that the spearhead had been forged in about the 6th or 7th century. It couldn't possibly have been used in the piercing of the side of Christ. And yet that's
you know, all the carbon-14 dating isn't always accurate either.
Right. And that's the object that that certainly came from Charlemagne. Its provenance from Charlemagne to Hitler is pretty much unquestioned.
That's an interesting corollary when you talk about power, world power, too.
Uh-huh.
Amazing that all these world greats held this. Well, we're going to have to start wrapping up our conversation about this, and I want to be sure to give your website out, and then we'll continue on until our producer says it's time. You're at AdventuresUnlimited.com or Adventures Unlimited Press.
AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com,
mm-hmm.
And George and I set up a website just for this book, which
okay.
is easy to remember, spearbook.com,
S-P-E-A-R-B-O-O-K,
spearbook.com. You don't even need the darn W's to get there. And at spearbook.com, you'll get excerpts from the book, a mm-hmm. gallery of images of things associated with the spear, and you can order copies autographed by both George and I from that site. Or you can go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com or your local Barnes & Noble or Borders, and that would be good, too. If you get it from your local bookstore, that would help to increase its shelf presence.
Right. That's wonderful. And I do recommend the book, and I think it's a very interesting read. There's a lot of interesting history interspersed with spirituality throughout the book. We encourage our listeners to visit your site. And thank you so much for enlightening us about the secrets of the Holy Lance and the wonderful research that you have done. I know we could go on and on for hours. And I want to also, before we close, mention my website for our listeners so that they can check out my books and services at www.DianaSpeaksToTheWorld.com. I have messages posted from John Lennon and Princess Diana, along with my book, With Love from Diana. And next week, we're going to start a new series on our study of ascension. And Jerry, thanks again for joining us. It was a pleasure to speak with you and to have reviewed your book. You did an excellent job. And we are now going to tune in to some of the music that we feature. I'd like to play The Remarkable Diana, so you'll be hearing that shortly. Thank you, all of our listeners, for joining us and for your patience in that we had the wrong Jerry at the beginning, but we've got the right guy now. We'll pick up with you next time. Many blessings and much love and peace upon the earth at this crucial time. This is your host, Marcia McMahon, signing off for today, and we're about to hear The Remarkable Diana.